Also, the title board is not there. And the title board has 45 separate items on their agenda. 24 of those are after. Getting the letter from the board. Another couple of them. That's fairly common. So, especially in the other places. Do have. I hope that one people can learn. And it's good. We follow up. Time to do it. Planning to do it. And this one. After. Three. This one. Four. Five. But once in a while, that goes. Looking to the board. Officer. People. I'm going to see what. And we got. Open. But I hope. That now due to your. We can make. Without doing. And we are. Part of that. Title board. 45. Have a number of instances. And a number of possible. Quite. Every. Kind of work. Takes a lot of detail. And 43. Work. Deals with. That. And the point. Run to work. On. As well. The recommendation. From the top. When you. In a way. That. A lot of. Hold. And. And. That. The way.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Today is sort of a preliminary meeting where we kind of set some ground rules and we talk about some topics, kind of get some stuff on the table, and make a schedule for where we go from here. So I have a lot of paper for you. Kind of lay out some ideas. We're going to demonstrate a couple of things. We're going to talk a little bit about SCORE and the way our system works, just to kind of give you an underpinning of the kinds of technology that we have, which informs the decisions that we're going to have to make. One thing that I think would be helpful to start out, though, is for us all to introduce ourselves, because I'm sure that many of us don't know the other person across the table. So, and I, by the way, it's an odd configuration, but the idea was to get everybody close to mics. In the future, we'll be downstairs in the Bruce room, which is much more conducive to these kinds of circular discussions. Hopefully it's not totally a circular discussion, but you get my point. Next time we'll be in a more sort of functional environment. But in this particular case, as you are speaking, you might want to grab one of the microphones and you press the little button, and when the green light lights up, you know you're on the air so that people all around the state can listen to you. I'll introduce myself to start. My name is Judd Choate. I am the director of the Division of Elections. I've been here for about 6 months now. My background is that I have a PhD in political science. I taught campaigns and elections at the University of Nebraska. And I have a law degree from the University of Colorado, and where I focused on election law. And then I worked for the Colorado Supreme Court for Justice Alex Martinez for a couple of years, where we did quite a bit of election law when I was there. I kind of got lucky. We had a lot of title board issues. And then I worked for Kelly Garnsey Hubbell & Lass, which is a firm that does a lot of election law that you might be familiar with, along with one of the other members that's on the commission here. So And then, like I say, about 6 months ago, I was hired to run the divisional election. So that's how I got here. So why don't we go around and everybody can kind of repeat the process. Carol, would you like to start?
My name is Carol.
You got to start with
me. Okay.
There you go. Well, I think you have to press. There you go.
My name is Carol Tone, and I've been following election laws and procedures and so forth for the League of Women Voters for the last maybe 5 years.
And I'm Joe Ritchie. I've been an elections buff really since my first job out of college with the Gallup poll. I traveled and observed elections informally as a journalist in Costa Rica and Nicaragua and Argentina, and I've been really interested in Colorado's elections in the last, oh, since really 2003, and I've been involved with a number of public interest groups observing the changes and quite honestly trying to stave off the move toward a mandatory mail-in ballot. So I especially appreciate being included on the commission to hear those views too. I see my role and contribution, really I field a lot of information from people around the state and nationally. A lot of my interest has been an academic interest. We haven't had the chance to contribute that substantially to any major legislation with the groups I've worked with. But I like to say we add fiber to bills now and again. And I hope I can continue to do the same. I appreciate the invitation. Joe Ritchie here.
Hi, my name is Stephanie O'Malley. I serve as the elected clerk and recorder for the city and county of Denver. And like the two folks that spoke before me, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to be an active participant in these dialogues and discussions. And I view them as being very, very critical in light of the elections environment that we continue to face here in the state of Colorado. A little bit about my background. I'm an attorney by profession. Was originally appointed to this position prior to a change in the charter in the city and county of Denver that required my position to become an elected one. So this is my first term as a city and county clerk, and I appreciate the work and will continue to work hard on behalf of my constituents and in the state of Colorado as a whole.
My name's Mickey Wadda. Oops. There we go. My name is Mickey Wadhams, and I'm a paralegal with Collins, Cockrell, and Cole. I've been with them for 22 years, and we primarily represent special districts and municipalities statewide. So I've been working with municipal and special district elections since actually 1988, and that was well before special districts were required to comply with Title I. We were under Title 32 election code at that time. So definitely I've seen a lot of changes in elections over the last 22 years regarding special districts. So.
Good afternoon, I'm Pam Anderson. I am the Jefferson County Clerk and Recorder. I very much appreciate being invited to serve on the commission. I really look forward to the discussion. I think we have a lot to talk about, that's for sure. Seeing all the changes that we have seen just in my tenure, I'm also a first-term clerk, finishing up my first term. Prior to that, I served as the Wheat Ridge City Clerk, so have some municipal experience. I have a master's in public administration, and prior to that, I did serve as, down as the legislature as a legislative aide for several members that might remain, would prefer to remain nameless. But so I appreciate being here, and I'm really looking forward to having these discussions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Catherine Young, and I'm the Colorado Springs City Clerk. I've been the clerk in Colorado Springs now for going on 16 years. 28-year employee for the city of Colorado Springs. And no, I'm not ready to retire yet. I have my certified municipal clerk's designation, and I'm also a CERA designated an official through the election center. And I have a dual master's degree in management and procurement and acquisitions management, past president for the Colorado Municipal Clerks Association, and I am here to help represent the municipal side of elections and to do what I can to help speed this process up and to make it better. I'm Garland Brown, Washington County Clerk and Recorder. I've been conducting elections for 26 years as a clerk and recorder. I come from a very small county. We have only 3,000 voters, so I'm here mainly to represent the small counties in rural Colorado. I do appreciate and feel honored that I was asked to serve on this committee. I've also been past president of the County Clerks Association. I'm just here to see what we can do to improve elections.
My name is Kevin Pohl, and I'm an attorney in private practice here in Denver. My law firm, Heiser Pohl, is very active in campaign finance issues. We represent candidates, political committees, and issue committees, work at levels all the way from school district to the federal level. And we also have an active practice representing towns and cities and special districts, including in election law issues. And I look very much forward to working with all of you on this.
State Representative Carol Murray, Castle Rock. I am a former county clerk and recorder, and I have to say that county clerks are the hardest working county officials in the state, bar none. They not only do elections, but they do motor vehicle and several other functions. So I bow down to county clerks in this process, and I think we should always remember that the election process is a human process, and the less complex we make it, the fewer human errors there will be. And since the year 2000, when I was a clerk and the world exploded in elections and everyone became an election expert, instead of making it simpler, we've made it more complex, which to me gives us more opportunity for error. So I guess my goal in anything I do with elections is to try to simplify the process, to create a more perfect process. And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Bernie.
I'm Martha Tanner. I'm an attorney in private practice with the law firm of Kelly Garnsey, Hubbell & Lass, and I also am counsel to the Colorado Democratic Party. My practice involves a lot of election work, both straight election and campaign finance and other kinds of political work. And I'm delighted to be here, too. I think there's lots to be done. And I'm hoping that we can make some changes for the positive of the voters of Colorado.
Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Call, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hale Westfall here in Denver. Serve in a counsel role with that firm, and as general counsel for the Colorado Republican Party and a number of other candidates and party committees and different organizations we've represented over the years. My background in elections is, I think, probably more as an activist. I got my start in the college Republicans and different volunteer-based organizations like that over the years. But has been kind of working really since the kind of late 90s, I guess, in volunteer capacities and then in formal leadership capacities. I also serve as the volunteer chairman for the Denver County Republican Party. So perspectives kind of run the gamut with that. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you.
All right, thank you. So here's what we're going to do. The first thing I want to do is pass around a sign-up sheet so that Sherry Mazur, who is taking minutes today, will know who everyone is so that we can identify those speakers as they say things and make sure the minutes are correct. And then we'll go down the agenda. Does anyone need another copy of the agenda? I brought extras. Anybody out there? Couple of extras for the audience. The first topic on the agenda was to go over the proposed bylaws. I sent those, or they were sent, I think Sherry sent them, in an email that went out yesterday. I propose that I walk through them real quick, and then we can comment as we go, or we can you can approve them and say they're perfect, and we can move on. The idea of this is basically in the rule that created the Best Practices and Vision Commission, there were a number of different restrictions, limitations, guidelines for the way that it should work, but it didn't fill in all the gaps in the actual operation and the day-to-day functioning of the way issues would be brought before the commission and the way that they would be disposed of once they were brought. So. In reviewing that rule, I decided that it might be a good idea to actually introduce some bylaws with regard to how we would come to decisions. So I kind of laid out some of the things here. First of all, that we would provide an agenda, that agenda would be provided 24 hours prior to a meeting, and that the commissioners would be given on that agenda an opportunity to bring up new topics that didn't actually make the agenda. It's also the case that the that members can volunteer items that they want to be included in the agenda, but according to these bylaws, as we've currently constructed them, it would be up to the chair, myself, or to the secretary as to whether or not those topics actually made the full agenda. Now, again, they could be brought up during the open mic time at the end of a meeting. The actual meetings would be set 7 days in advance so that you would get at least 7 days notice. Obviously, the idea would be there would be significantly more notice than that. But certainly, if we found ourselves in an emergency situation, we would try to get something set up, give you enough time to actually block out some time in your schedule. committees can be formed by the chair and by the Secretary of State. As we go into very substantive detail on particular issues, we're probably going to need to form committees to actually deal with specifics. One of the things that we're hopeful of doing is to make sure that we staff up some of the more challenging issues as they arise, because, for instance, one of the things you're going to hear about later on today is that we have a federal law that we're going to violate this fall, that with regard to the time in which it takes for us to distribute ballots out to members of the military. And because we're in violation of that law, we've asked for a waiver of that law for this fall, and we have yet to hear whether or not that waiver is going to be approved. Actually, we haven't submitted it yet, but we're very near submitting that waiver request. The change for 2012 that would be necessary would be a full calendar change. We would need to go back and literally rewrite the calendar. Now, we don't have that power. The legislature has that power. But we can staff it up. We can figure out what calendar we would recommend, make some substantive suggestions to the legislature, vote on that, and then present that to the legislature as the views of the Best Practices and Vision Commission. And we think that under those circumstances, given the composition of this committee and the importance of that issue, that we would have a great deal of leverage in trying to make that issue take that issue to the legislature and have them understand the importance of making those moves, making those adjustments, so as to fulfill the needs of municipalities, special districts, the parties, all of the different constituency groups that are represented by those problems, by the issues that come up with changing your calendar. So that's a great example of the fact that we're probably going to need to do some sort of committee work on that. We're probably going to need to bring in staff to help kind of lay out what the various dominoes are that will fall once we start doing calendar changes. So as we get into that process, we're probably going to need to do some of those things. We also define a quorum as two-thirds. Quorum is presumed to exist unless it's called, and we won't operate unless we have at least half. We'll take minutes, and those minutes will be distributed at the same time if we set a meeting 7 days in advance, we'll provide those minutes at that point. We'll also provide minutes 7 days in advance if we have a scheduled meeting that's on the calendar some distance. The decisions of the commission, we hope, and the secretary has made this point on several occasions to me, we hope that the commission will be governed by consensus, but it is the case that we're likely going to find ourselves at loggerheads on occasion. So the idea of this would be that we would do active votes, and those votes would be called by the chair or the secretary of state, and that a vote would be a vote in favor would be above 50%. Only the commissioners may vote. They only may vote if they're present, and there's no proxies. There would be a possible occasion where we would call a vote based on an issue perhaps we've discussed, perhaps we haven't discussed, but we'd call that vote remotely. So we'd call that vote by email or by phone, and then obviously under those circumstances you wouldn't need to be present to vote. But those are the basic pillars of the bylaws. Did anyone have any comments?
To clarify, then, when you say 50%, it's 50% of those voting?
50% of those voting plus 50%, so it would be 50 plus 1. Obviously, if you get a 6-6 vote, then you haven't approved it. But if you get a 6-5 vote, then yes, you have 6 of the 11 that are present, of those who have voted. Yeah. So I guess, to give an example, if we had 9 people present, and a quorum wasn't called, and we voted, and the vote was 5-4, then yeah, I guess we've got a majority. That's the way the rules are written currently. Unless, of course, you'd like to go and discuss that, we can. Whoever?
I'm just imagining the most important occasion for voting would be when we're actually coming up with recommendations. And along the way, getting to that point, I don't know, I need some examples of what we'd be voting on, for instance, other than time and logistics of holding meetings.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. I think we would be voting largely on recommendations. I think most of the stuff that this commission will do will be done, you know, by proclamation, basically. You know, we'll decide beforehand, you know, what things will be on the agenda, and we'll discuss those things, and when it's proposed that we have committees or that propose that we bring in certain information, or certain people be brought in to give us information, I think those things are going to be pretty easy, and we'll just do it by, you know, proclamation. But on those rare occasions when we're making formal recommendations to the secretary, we'll probably do a formal vote, and, you know, we'll count heads, and the majority will win. Yes, ma'am.
And again, to clarify, people will be given the option to vote by phone.
They'll be given the option to vote by phone if, yes, so like let's say we're doing a meeting and someone is on the phone, they can vote by phone, absolutely. And that may not be totally clear. Maybe I can clear that up in the bylaws. One of the things that's in the rule, which isn't in the bylaws that you see here, but in the rule that created this commission is that you can participate by phone. So if you can participate by phone, then that full participation would necessarily mean that you could vote by phone as well. But, yeah, I'll clarify that in the language. Any other comments? Yes, Ryan.
Just a kind of maybe a procedural or organizational question. Are bylaws the proper sort of governing instrument here, or is this more properly identified as standing rules in terms of the conduct of the commission? It doesn't seem to me that the commission really has a separate legal entity status or organizational structure. It seems to me that a more proper identification of what this is we're adopting is really standing rules to govern the conduct of our commission and our meetings. Is that perhaps accurate, or does the rule contemplate that we're really creating a formal standalone separate body? I would say so. Part of it also has to do with standing rules can be waived. Standing rules can be amended by a two-thirds vote of the members. Bylaws tend to provide more of a kind of a governing instrument or governing document. just as a matter of sort of custom, but I'm open to comments from the other folks.
This organization has a rule that you like the Constitution,
sure,
or the Charter for Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there is a must in my life for operating. I don't have a concrete one or other basic understanding of how it is. On the way down the line, turn out with conversation.
Certainly.
I don't either. Is there any discussion? Well, why don't I do a little investigating and we'll decide how to frame it.
That's great.
Okay.
When my only model for understanding how this might work is from the last Election Reform Commission,
mm-hmm,
and in the report they produced, it included recommendations not approved by the commission, so dissenting views were there, mm-hmm, along with, and I wondered if that would also be included in the public record, how the commission feels on that.
Does anybody have any thoughts on?
I think there's a lot of value for allowing for a minority report or allowing for, you know, something along those lines, and whether it needs to be made explicit that that's permitted or just by not saying we can't do it, it's sort of understood that we can, I think is fine. But I would concur that there's, with the recognizing that we're not likely to come, well, maybe in some issues, to unanimity of opinion, having the ability to have a minority report or dissenting sort of positions by commissioners in their own standing is probably useful. Just as a matter of maybe a separate issue, but addressing some issues of the bylaws, I would like to see at least the ability for, if not a single commissioner, at least three or four commissioners who want to see issues added to the formal agenda, have that be the ability rather than simply just the chairman or the secretary controls the agenda. If the commission's going to have its own voice, I think commissioners need to be empowered to add other items to the agenda more formally. So I might recommend that maybe you need to have some sort of a safeguard to say, you know, three or four members or mm-hmm, one third can add new items to the agenda, something like that.
Okay. Let me, is there any discussion on that? Yeah, that sounds fine to me too. So how about one third of commissioners can formally request an addition to the agenda and fine.
I think one of the things I think is that the vote be shown,
mm-hmm,
and that there be an opportunity to have a minority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Any other questions?
Just
comments?
One kind of semantic observation. You could probably strike the word bear from majority. That's kind of duplicative in the final word of the bylaws.
Okay.
And then if we are looking at essentially having procedural steps to kind of govern the conduct of our meeting, do we need to identify an appropriate standard of rules to govern our conduct? I know that the legislature has standing rules in terms of the conduct of things, or most organizations will perhaps incorporate by reference Roberts or some other parliamentary authority in terms of the conduct of meetings and limiting debate and providing some structure and guidelines for the conduct of our meetings. If that would be helpful, I don't want to cumber it, make it too cumbersome, but if an appeal to or an incorporation by an appropriate parliamentary authority could help know the guidelines for conducting the meeting, that might be helpful.
I think it's Roberts do that. We tend fairly dramatically with instructions for discussions rather than anything more important. Unless we have a problem, I'd rather have less. That's something we can certainly revisit. Thank you. But I'd rather not do that on the front end, just because I think the discussion can be
a little more free flowing without having to go through the chair, for example.
No objection from here.
Yeah, and actually, early on when I was kind of working on these, I kind of consciously thought, gosh, I don't think I want to be burdened by that, or at least then I'd have to learn them, which I'm not prepared to do, I don't think. But I think it's a valuable suggestion. Any other questions or comments about the bylaws? Well, why don't I do this? Why don't I work on some revisions, and we'll bring those to next time, and hopefully in between we'll communicate and make any smaller changes that you feel are necessary, and then I'll bring them next time to be approved. It'll be our first vote. Okay, excellent. So the next thing we wanted to do was to kind of go through some of the major topic areas that would be coming up. And I have lost the only copy of my agenda. Can I have one of the? Because otherwise I'm going to be lost. Excellent. Thank you. I will take one of these. Oh, okay. I've got all sorts of things. Okay. So if you've been reading the newspaper recently, you've probably seen that there have been some discussions of election topics in the news, some of which are listed here. Basically, the discussion that the clerks and the speaker and the governor's office have been having about statewide mail ballot and registration changes has evolved, and I'm not exactly sure where that's going to go. We haven't been formally notified one way or another of what the speaker's intentions are, but we see them as ongoing topics that we're probably going to need to be working on. So one of the things that we wanted to do was to at least preview some of these topic areas so that you are at least more familiar with them, more familiar with the technical side of them, because in many respects these involve SCORE and our statewide registration system. So that's one of the things that we're going to do here shortly. The other idea, the other kind of principle of this is that we're the legislature to decide not to move forward on a bill this session. We would like to, the Secretary is very interested in us taking a lead on working on legislation or framing legislation for introduction in the next session. So obviously we would find legislators to carry that bill and so forth. It wouldn't necessarily be a bill from best practices or from the Secretary of State's office, but at least having this discussion in this group, and perhaps over the course of several months having witnesses, having testimony, all that kind of thing, would help to frame a discussion that could go forward in legislation. With that, let's actually dive into some of the details of the first one of our topics, which is statewide mail ballot. I have paper for you. First, I want to pass around a copy of, let me take one for myself. This is a, what I'm passing around is it's a three sheets actually, they're stapled together, and they include the costs of elections, the cost of the 2008 election, the projected cost of the 2008 election by polling place and then by mail ballot. And the mail ballot part is sort of a predicted cost based on what the counties returned as their estimate of costs for a polling place as opposed to a mail ballot. This was a document that was produced by Russ Ragsdale, who is the clerk and recorder for Broomfield. And it is based on a survey that was done of the counties following the 2008 election. We have, I'll give you a moment to look at it. It's basically divided into three sections. The first one is for those counties with more than 75,000 registrants. The second One is for registrants or of counties that have registrants of 32 to 10,000. And then the third one is for counties with fewer than 10,000 registrants. And the columns are active registrants, the polling place cost, the mail-in ballot costs, and then the percentage saved by mail-in ballot. You'll note as you flip through these that the that there are several counties that didn't answer or didn't provide some portion of information, so it was impossible to know on, in some cases what the costs were. Or it's certainly possible that, that there were clerical issues as well. So the information is largely provided here. There is more complete information, I'm sure. There are, if you look again through the list, there are two counties, and they're both within the 10,000 and fewer category, that report that mail-in ballot would actually be more expensive. But of those counties that respond, we're looking at around 50 counties saying that you save money, a couple of counties saying you lose money, and then we have about a dozen or so that haven't included either partial or full data. Or Russ didn't write it down. That's sort of one basis point to understand the push for mail ballot. I think it's not too much to say that in my capacity, in my position, I've received several comments from clerks and recorders indicating wide agreement that mail ballot is the preference of the clerks. There are exceptions to that, but for the most part, it's a preference on the part of the clerks. It is, as I understand it, it's a preference largely because of cost and because of now having done it a couple of times, certainly done it once in a off-year election, and now lining up to do it in many, many counties this primary. There's a little bit more comfort with it, a little bit more comfort that you can do it. The state now, in our score system, the state, over 50% of those who are registered in the state of Colorado have selected mail ballot as their preferred way of voting. So all of those things, I think, sort of are pointing clerks in that direction. We obviously have clerks here who can speak for themselves if anyone would like to comment along those lines. And I have additional information, too.
This is Pam Anderson. I would agree with that. I think your description is accurate, Jed. I would only add that I think this evolution has happened over time with respect to mail ballot, odd year coordinated elections, and then with the implementation of permanent mail-in voting, that I think a lot of this is being driven in some respects to where we're reaching that tipping point with respect to costs versus polling place versus mail-in ballot and the infrastructure that you have in place. And I think that there are several counties that are also looking at future equipment systems replacement and the capital investment that's going to be needed to replace our current systems. There's been, as we all know at this table, there's been a great deal of debate on current election systems. We had a lot of legislation last session on the topic. And what election administrators across state know is that there's a significant capital investment and finding some direction and vision for how we're going to conduct these elections prior to that shift. And for some counties, it's sooner rather than later. And so I think that's, you know, a really appropriate context for which this policy debate is being driven.
John, if I could interrupt. The Speaker, Terrence Carroll, just announced, I think not unexpectedly, that he will not be introducing an elections modernization bill this session. We'll have copies of his statement for members of the commission here in a few minutes. I will read one paragraph. It says, while we couldn't build the needed support this year, I urge the important conversations to be continued by the Secretary of State and his Election Best Practices and Vision Commission. I hope that they will continue to work for a 21st century election model in Colorado and expand the conversation beyond the members of the commission. I hope that all important stakeholders who have been involved in this conversation thus far will continue to be involved. I hope that the valuable coalition, its shared commitment, and the important work are not lost. We're working, Rich Coolidge is working on a statement from our office, but I think there is an important point in here that I may not have emphasized enough in my early remarks. There are an awful lot of folks who are interested in elections who are not members of the commission. You just can't put everybody on, and I do hope that ultimately we develop a process for this commission which allows for input by various interested parties, that the input for this commission not just come from the secretary's office or the clerk's offices, but also from other groups that are interested in this subject. And I think the speaker is emphasizing that in his press release. And again, we'll have copies of the speaker's press release and the press release that Rich and I have been working on before you leave this afternoon.
Well, good, because we didn't have enough to do before, so that should give us something to do. So, no, it's not unanticipated, and because of that, I suspect that, well, that's, you can kind of see it in the agenda. I mean, we already kind of lined up many of these issues as being important. One of the things in the statewide mail ballot issue is the degree to which we're sort of comfortable as a state and comfortable, the clerks and recorders are comfortable, and those who are concerned about fraud on one end or disenfranchisement on the other are comfortable. It is the case that in 2009, and stop me if I'm wrong, I believe it was 57 counties did mail ballot. Is that right? I think that's right. I think it was 57 of 64 did statewide or did mail ballot. In, of course, that's an off-year election, but it's instructive. And then I just passed out a map of the state of Colorado in this 2010 primary election, and you can see if you count them up, I think there's 45 counties that have chosen mail ballot for this primary cycle. There's about another 15 or so that have chosen to do a polling place, and then we have vote centers at a couple of different counties. So there's a seeming interest on the part of many counties to pursue the mail ballot. So that's obviously an issue to consider.
This may come as no surprise, but I want to make sure that as we have that discussion about all mail ballot and moving in that direction, we think about trying to balance what I've recognized are very challenging economic times and costs with what offers the best venue or opportunities for the voter to vote. And I am very strongly in favor of maintaining at least some venue of opportunity for the voter to vote, whether it be retaining both early vote, some sort of voting day, election day voting opportunity, and a mail-in ballot for those who opt to take advantage of that. And I think that maintaining that menu of options provides the highest opportunity, the best opportunity for the voters of Colorado to be able to vote on election day. So I just hope that we'll keep in mind that difficult balance as we embark on that discussion.
I think Martha, that's a sign from the Almighty that he agrees.
Almighty Microsoft.
Something like that, exactly. Bill Gates is weighing in appropriately. I appreciate members of the commission talking to the microphone. I understand that there's lots of people listening in, and I think that's that ongoing conversation, because there is a lot of different competing interests here, and it's a challenge. And I would echo and concur in large measure with what my colleague has indicated, because I think one of the strengths of Colorado's system is the choices that we provided and the options that we make available to voters. I understand that creates added complexity, but I also think it creates a lot more access to folks to be able to participate in the franchise. And I think that that's a strength of our system. And if we drive people into boxes, that I think is not the right direction to be going.
Mr. Chair. Hi, this is Stephanie O'Malley. A couple of comments I'd like to make, as you talked about the cost as part of this discussion. And as we move forward and continue to have cost questions, I always get a little nervous when I see numbers presented like this, because over 64 counties, because I don't know how they were validated. I don't know how they were put together. I'm certain that my county probably has a different formula than another county. And so if we're going to have true cost discussions in this dialogue, I think it would be prudent to have formulas that's consistent, that we can derive actual costs in a consistent way rather than in many, many, many different forms in different ways. So I'd like to put that out there as some food for thought. And then relative to just the mail ballot discussion, I've personally been involved in these discussions over the past 6 weeks, or I should say part of the 6 weeks, and have found the dialogue to be very valuable. I think we've made some significant progress in terms of at least providing some understanding to a lot of folks that were involved in the discussions as to exactly where Colorado has come from relative to a mail ballot environment. I like the word evolution. I've used that in the context of some of my comments to folks that I've talked about, and understanding that, you know, the elections environment, just as any other environments over time, evolves into different animals. And I think we have to recognize, as part of the evolution in Colorado, that the use of a mail ballot has increased significantly over the 64 counties. But I also believe that we have to continue to recognize the voter who has chosen not to use their franchise by a mail ballot. And those numbers still remain in the high 40 percentile range, okay? And I'm sensitized to that voter from my point of view on this commission. And in my discussions over the past few weeks, I've made suggestions as how to be sensitized to that voter, suggesting that the opt-in provision, you know, in an all-mail ballot, an opt-out provision in an all-mail ballot election. And I hope that we continue to be sensitized to those voters who in no form or fashion want anything to do with the receipt of a mail ballot, you know. And we're going to have to figure out in this discussion, how do we take those folks into consideration?
This is Joe Ritchie. I have to say that the term evolution doesn't always work, because it seems to be like an entity that just evolves on its own. Looking forward sometimes requires looking back a little, and I know in 2002 Colorado had a ballot initiative on whether to become an all-ballot state or not, and I think that was defeated fairly handily. But since then, and in spite of that will of the people, let's say, we've moved more and more in little steps, not so much evolving, but really with intent, in the best of economic times, and now with the crisis, the costs are becoming the driver. But there was another driver. The Clerks Association in particular seemed to want to alleviate the administrative burden of running precinct elections. That look back and how we got to this place, I think, is important to the discussion. I do think the costs really do need a more thorough cost survey. When I read, you know, the savings range between 35% and 78%,
there's a lot of play there, and it'd be great to be able to tell voters what the actual cost savings is for eliminating these options to vote. I remember seeing Les Ragsdale's original study, and it came with a pretty important disclaimer that the numbers were inaccurate and incomplete. So I wondered if these numbers have been updated since that original release with more thorough numbers, and maybe hidden costs were discovered along the way.
If I could respond to a couple of thoughts, just by way of adding some information. I do think we've seen an evolution of voters increasingly making a choice to be permanent all-mail ballot voters. I've seen some data suggesting that individuals that are registering anew are increasingly making that decision. It's not a surprise, but we'll try to give you good data on that. I think also the point that the finances in this area are quite tricky is true. We've compiled information from all of the counties asking them to explain to us their cost using a spreadsheet of common categories. The problem is that the counties don't keep track of their dollars the same way we would like them to report it. And some of the contracts, particularly the contracts with HART, for example, include multiple services. And the counties don't break out those services into the categories that we would like to see. I have a high degree of confidence in the total costs of the county for the elections. I have a lesser degree confidence level in the breakout between polling place and mail-in ballot. But I think that is a matter of the details, but not the overall picture. I mean, the line may not be at 66%, but it's certainly not at 35. The line may not be at 58, but it's certainly not at 97. And we're going to continue to work with the counties to try to improve the quality of that reporting as we go forward. It had never been really compiled the way we're asking for it until this year. So that's again, an iterative process, and we'll try to get good data for this commission to use. But I think the general ideas are pretty accurate. Not precisely accurate, but pretty accurate. Western Colorado term.
In rural Colorado, some of the reason that it's moving more towards mail ballot is distance. In my county, I have 70 miles between polling places, and it isn't easy for us to set up vote centers. The other thing is getting election judges. That's becoming an issue. We have an older population that are election judges because the younger population works and they don't have the time to be election judges. Is another reason that mail ballots are a little bit more, to my thinking, what we would like to do. Cost-wise, right now with doing elections, we have voting machines. We also have to order paper ballots. We order provisional ballots. And we have the mail-in ballots. That is where the cost comes in because you don't know how many to order, how many to send out to the polling places, how many provisionals to order. The machines you can program, they're ready to go. But that's where some of the costs come in that haven't been mentioned. Thank you. And this is Carly Ball.
We've got a bunch of things to go through, and I don't think today is the point at which we debate this issue, but it is the point for members of the commission to ask us what information would you like us to compile for you in order for you to have the information you'd like to have.
You know, and one thing that might be helpful for a future meeting, would you like me to I can ask Russ Ragsdale to come in, and he can present this data, or we could ask individual clerks and recorders to come in and describe what their county's calculation is and how they base that calculation. I mean, I'm happy to bring in any witnesses that make sense to compile that data or demonstrate that data in a fashion that's most palatable to the commission.
Well, I think Colorado Canvas has also done some work on compiling information about election costs, and they may be a resource also.
Okay.
Yeah, Carol Murray, I'm sorry. I don't feel a need for that additional information. I have on-the-ground knowledge that Douglas counties are very accurate, and I know there is simply no question that there are large dollars to be saved by mail ballots. You know, I would rather we spend our time discussing the details, whether we should go to mail ballot or not, and if we do, what they should, what should be involved in it, without quibbling about the figures. So that's just my opinion. Sorry.
Okay.
Pam Anderson. I think that actually some additional data that might be useful, and Russ Ragsdale serves on the national stage with respect to election systems, maybe to figure out some way to estimate the potential replacement cost of election systems in Colorado, because that is the next real I don't want to say barrier, but that's the next big looming thing. You know, what we're talking about right here is our operating costs, and there is a significant difference, I can say, between providing choice and limiting, you know, the types of elections you provide, and so many different variables that can play into that. I think that there are a lot of clerks very concerned about the next step. When we replace these systems, what is going to be that cost? And I think that plays into a policy decision such as this as well, when we're just talking about cost.
Russ Ragsdale is on, and I want to say it's the, there you go, TGDC, right, which stands for, I'm sure, something. Guidelines. And he's one of the board members, so he's a very prominent person in this organization, which is a national organization which deals with electronic voting equipment.
Just for levity, I'm sure, Russ, if you're listening, you're just thrilled to death with this entire discussion.
So maybe it would be beneficial to invite him in for the next meeting to discuss the costs or issues related to the evolution of the voting equipment, because that's one of the big drivers here. In fact, the whole conversation that I think generated discussion on this bill started with a couple of members of the Clerks Association coming and talking to me and then talking to the secretary about the position of indecision that they were in. They had old equipment, some from 1998, 1999, equipment they needed to replace or decide how to refurbish or whatever. And they wanted to know, well, should I be buying equipment that deals with mail ballot, or should I be buying equipment that can do, you know, scans of bubble scan, you know? And so they were really in a position where they needed help there. So.
It would be great to get Russ in and confirm, you know, any additions that have made these numbers more complete than the original that was released. But in addition, if the Secretary's office and especially the clerks present could come up with a means of collecting data, cost data, for the 2010 election in a standardized way, it could be more useful to the legislature in 2011.
That's true. Actually, one of the things that I was considering was to propose that we, in some way, try to capture costs in the primary of this year, try to figure out to what degree counties that are doing mail-in ballot either saved or lost money because of that choice, how, and then vice versa for counties that chose to do polling place or vote centers, whether they saved or lost. So maybe there's some advantages in seeking that kind of information. I can certainly pursue it. Okay. Great, I will do that. Any other comments on that? So here's what I heard you tell me. I'll begin to discuss with the clerks collecting information about 2010 primary. It'll effectively be an audit of costs. I'll just sort of think about it in those terms. We'll invite Russ Ragsdale to come to the next meeting to discuss electronic voting and the issues related to technology and costs of election. And we might be able to get him to explain some of the data in the county costs that we currently have. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to suggest that if we're going to be collecting these costs for the 2010 primary, that we have the formula in place soon so that we can be working on it as we go, not after the election. Thank you.
I will begin working on it immediately. I think that's a very good point.
This would be useful for the general election, too, in November. Would this also be good for the same methodology or means of collecting data be used for the general election in November?
Well, hypothetically, sure. I think, I mean, one of the things that makes the primary election such a useful tool in this process is in terms of its actual application on the ground, it's very, very similar. There's only minor changes that you need to make to extrapolate to the general election. So, but that doesn't mean that we, you know, shouldn't do that as well. Absolutely, we can certainly.
It seems like there are a few counties that are going to run precinct polling places for the primary. So it would be hard to do comparative analysis there if we solely looked at primary elections.
Right, and so what my idea was to inquire with all counties, whether regardless of whether they're doing mail-in ballot or polling place or service center, and have them discuss for us their the finances of that choice, effectively. So, okay, the next topic, did we cover reasonable opt-out? We didn't really get into it, but it's certainly one that we know is necessary and on the agenda for anything we talk about with regard to mail ballot. We would need to obviously have an opt-out procedure there. So one of the things that was also a part of the discussion that surrounded the possible legislation was to enhance registration opportunities. That's how, like, a broad term. There are other terms that have been thrown around, like same-day registration, election day registration, you know, election or registration expansion. All of those sort of take into account or get you to the point where you're considering, do our current provisions with regard to registration accurately, you know, represent what we want in terms of fulfilling the needs of the clerks to get accurate information, which will allow them to send out a ballot or to prepare a ballot in the polling place, and does it necessarily, you know, prevent the fraud and bring enough enfranchisement to satisfy our you know, our needs legislatively? So there was a whole bunch of sort of back and forth on those topics when we were discussing this in terms of a potential bill. One of the things that I thought might be useful along those lines would be to demonstrate our system the way it currently operates within SCORE. And the idea being that some of the concerns about mail ballot in combination with a more, you know, expanded registration opportunity is that people might be able to mail their ballot and then go in and vote, or they might be able to mail their ballot or hand in a mail ballot and then claim that they didn't mail in their hand out in their mail ballot and go vote, or, you know, some combination which might potentially create fraud and There, of course, were various stories around about the ways in which you could kind of get around this, and it would allow you to double vote. So we thought it might be useful to actually demonstrate what a clerk and recorder or the staff of a clerk and recorder sees in our system when someone votes or when somebody registers and how that changes or might be affected by advancing the registration deadline either a week or 2 weeks or even going all the way to Election Day. And so I ask Carrie Ashley, she's over there, to do a quick demonstration for us of our score system. And Carrie has to get in front of a microphone, otherwise she's not going to be widely heard.
Thank you. So I'll just do a really quick demonstration. I think after speaking with Jed, I think the things that we want to address the most is showing how if a voter has already been issued a ballot in one county and then they move to another county and we don't have a registration cutoff is actually Election Day or the Friday before or whatever, then if they've already voted that ballot in another county, the system will not allow you to issue them a second ballot in the new county that they've moved into. It recognizes that they've been issued a ballot and they can tell whether that ballot is just in a send stage, whether it's in a receive stage by the county, et cetera, and there are warnings in place for that. So that's kind of what I was going to focus on, if that's okay, Jed. Okay, so what I'm going to show you here is we're just going to go into a voter record really quickly. And just so everybody knows, this is a sandbox environment. It's a play environment. It's not actually, I'm not going to be touching voter records or moving them around from county to county. So this is in Lincoln County. And if I go in and try to pull up a voter, let's say in that currently resides in San Juan County, and they are going to be moving to Lincoln County and try to register. Okay, so this voter, Patricia Blackmore, is currently registered in Silverton. You can see down here that she has an active ballot. If we go up to this active ballot screen, it's going to show more information. So her ballot stage currently is validated, which means it has been received by the county, has been accepted, she's voted it, and it's been processed by the county. So at this point, we're going to say that Patricia has moved to Lincoln County and has submitted a new voter registration form before the election. So I'm acting as if I'm a clerk in Lincoln County, and I'm going to change her address. Alrighty, so I changed her address to a residential address in Hugo. I'm going to clear out the mailing address, and then I'm going to try and save the record. It's saying you can't save this record because this voter is part of an active election, cannot be moved to this county from San Juan County. So the system will not allow the clerk in Lincoln County to move the voter into their county, and it won't even allow them to move them into their county, more or less issue them a ballot. So that's the first safeguard that we have in place from there. The other thing I was going to show is like in the early voting environment, if somebody, where we have service centers or we have more than one voting option, mail ballot, early voting, et cetera, if they've already voted their mail ballot and then they appear at a service center, early voting site, whatever you want to call it, and try to vote there, we also have warnings in place. So again, I'm in Lincoln County in this election, and I'm going to pull up a voter if I can find my right sheet. Okay, so I've pulled up this Charlene Monks, and I'm going to say issue DRE because she wants to vote on the machines. Again, it's going to say I can't issue a DRE because this voter has absentee activity, cannot vote at the early voting center. In the instance that the ballot had just been in a sense stage, I could go in and void the ballot. We have the surrender, so you could void it and then allow them to vote. But where it's already been received and validated by the county, the system will absolutely not allow you to issue them a second ballot or to vote twice. So two scenarios I wanted to cover, like I say, in the early voting in-person environment and the ability to even move them into your county and issue them a ballot. Do you want me to demonstrate anything else, Judd, or do you guys have questions about that?
Does anybody have any questions about that? I have a couple questions. So let's say right now we have a 29-day voter registration cutoff.
Yes.
Let's say that we were to move that to 14 days. How would this process, how would our registration process be affected by a 14-day change, and would it make fraud or confusion on the part of county clerks more prevalent?
And certainly some of the clerks in the room maybe will speak better to this, but in when you set up an election, you enter certain dates that are appropriate for that election. You set up a registration deadline, ballot certification, all of those. So when the system is considering issuing a ballot, it's basing all the eligibilities off of the dates that were set up when the election was created. So in this case, you would just move up, you know, the election date. Instead of being 29 days before the election, it would now be 14 days before the election. And the system, as long as they hadn't already voted and returned a ballot, then as long as they were registered by that appropriate cutoff, it would go ahead and issue them a ballot. So I don't think a lot of the processes change. I think the moves from county to county are potentially where it may get a little complicated with ballots being in the air, being in sent stage or receive stage. But we have the validations and the checks in place in the system to prevent voting twice.
I think, this is Pam Anderson, an important clarification to make is that is only in the environment where we have Citrix access to score. If we had a paper system of registration and poll books instead of an electronic system, with technology, we're able to do that in this secure environment. If we were to see, a system that of same day or election day registration that did not require the voter to come to that sort of environment, of course we couldn't secure that.
The other thing I would mention, Judd, is in the instance that it was election day with polling place registration or something like that, the counties normally print their polling books on the Friday night or the Saturday before the election. So anybody that would be registering in school or whatever on that Monday or Tuesday, you'd have a hard time getting their names onto the polling place. Maybe Pam wants to address.
I think what is most accessible and maybe frustrating for lots of people, I think, is the amount of complexity and choice we have, and the different. I mean, we have polling place voting, but we also have vote centers. We have precinct voting. We have paper poll books. We have e-poll books, and the counties vary in how they administer their elections in that way. And so, for example, in my county, I am still in some combined precincts, but mostly precinct polling place. We have 321. I'm blanking on my numbers, precincts, and we have about 241 polling places. So we combine a few, the smaller mountain precincts and so on and so forth. But we have paper poll books. We do not have, because we're in that precinct-based system, we do not have an e-poll book system, which would require some sort of Citrix downloadable environment at that polling place ballot issuance. And so it gets complicated in a hurry. And so I think that level of variation is why and sometimes it seems like you have inconsistencies from the counties when really it's complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really a well-made point. And I think it does vary from county to county. And thank you. I apologize. One of the things that I've tried to get my mind around is the extent to which this can be broken into a discussion about broadband access or a discussion about any internet access. I haven't been able to get a good answer. How big does that pipe have to be in order to allow wherever the polling is going on to have reasonable access? Obviously, the ideal would be full broadband access at every polling place, but I don't think we're ever going. Well, it's going to be a while until we get there. But what are the limitations if it is dial-up access? What are the limitations if it is Wi-Fi access? And I haven't been able to get a good answer for that. Judd, I don't know if your folks have it or if you have any experience with that, Pam.
Well, I think the issues are different, for example, for the rural counties and their technological access to that sort of thing. Your conversation about safety as well, and security is an important one with respect to the online access and transmission, and what exactly are you passing through that system. And I think from the clerk's and the county's perspective, when you're talking about legislating, that sort of thing, it's about infrastructure. And who, how are you going to put that in, and who's going to pay for that, and is it possible across the entire state? And so I think our, the discussions this spring in particular have really pulled back to a mail ballot issuance sort of format and an opt-out format, because we know that we have largely the existing infrastructure in place to be able to safely issue ballots across the state with our new statewide system, our relatively new statewide system. And so when we're talking about our wish lists, you know, we have to keep that in mind. Can't, you know, what infrastructure do we have in place? If we don't, what is that going to look like? What's the cost? What's the security involved?
Mm-hmm. Catherine Young, one of the things that pops into my head right away is that while we all think about elections, we usually think about it in terms of county clerks and not the municipal clerks. And the municipal clerks do elections just as the county clerks do. So it's not just a county clerk issue. And I think we forget that most of the time. So therefore, when we have municipal clerks that have an election calendar to put together, and it's based off of the same structure that the county clerks do, then we need to include the municipal clerk side of this. We also don't have access to SCORE. And from what I understand, we won't have access to SCORE. So this probability that we're seeing right here doesn't even work for us. So what do we do when we have elections and we can't find out whether or not a voter is trying to vote twice, or there's fraud being committed, and there's no signature verification process for us? So we're being left out of this whole total process, and I think we have to be inclusive.
Catherine, thank you for that point. And as you know, we've had discussions about what access we can provide for the city clerks. And some of the cities can use the Citrix system, read-only, not read-write. Others don't have the ability to use the system at all. It makes me think that one of the issues that underlies this whole discussion and gets everybody, you know, really frustrated and scared is when we talk about how do we standardize or how do we have common practices, because we can't bridge that gap if some cities are not Citrix capable. There's just no way to get it done. So,
I only want to add to Kathy's comment about municipal clerks, but also special districts. I mean, they have no, you know, access to that, and we rely on the county clerks to assist us. So that, it's definitely a big problem when we start talking about all mail and this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think that Representative Murray and then Joe.
So I know there are some communities that are doing, cities that are doing mail ballots. How are they verifying signatures?
If they're doing mail ballot, there is no requirement that they have to do the signature verification unless they have been approved for the mail ballot plan through the Secretary of State's office. And if they come through the Secretary of State's office and they are doing a signature verification, then the Secretary of State's office has approved whatever their system is. But the majority of municipal clerks don't have this signature verification process.
So then to clarify, a city can do a mail ballot election without verifying signatures?
That's correct.
Ouch.
Absolutely. There's actually, and there's another layer of this I would just mention, which is that we have, I mean, we're sort of talking about costs and infrastructure on one side. There's also costs and infrastructure on the other side of this, which is that we have a limited number of Citrix licenses. And so we sort of dole those out, you know, very carefully. because we have a finite number. Now, we could buy a whole bunch more, but that's a big investment on our side. And is this where the state's going? Is the state going toward all mail ballot, and is that all mail ballot going to extend to municipalities and special districts? If it does, well, then there's sensibility behind buying all those extra licenses. If there's not, and we're going to continue doing polling places, well, then we're sort of in the same situation that Pam mentioned and Stephanie mentioned, which is that we're trying to figure out where the best investment of our money is, and we can't do it because we're sort of at a fork in the road and we're stopped. You know, we can't decide which way to go. So it's an infrastructure issue on our side as well.
Mm-hmm. This is Joe Ricci. I have questions about the poll book for some of the clerks here. I understood, you know, back in, I think, 2006, when tens of thousands of voters in Denver were turned away, it was due to an electronic poll book failure, and there was not a paper backup provided, so that was part of the cause of the delay. And I remember a couple of sessions ago working really hard to get an amendment to a bill that there would be a required paper poll book backed up, provided at every polling place in the event of a loss of connectivity or a system failure like happened in 2006. Getting that poll book printed into every polling place on election day is a 72-hour, this is my question, if the system works so well, could it be transmitted to every clerk in a timely manner Saturday morning and have enough printed backup to distribute?
I'll just address the question about transmitted. We actually don't transmit anything to the clerks. The clerks log into the system themselves, and they go and print their poll book at the time that they choose. So the state is not involved in the printing of the poll books at the county level.
This is Pam Anderson from Jefferson County, and we are one of the large counties that use printed poll books, and so we do generate the printed poll books for our precincts. There is an important time element, and again, it depends on the size of your county, your resources, the number of voters, the number of polling places, the number of precincts. We have a large operation, and we generate and print our poll books ourselves, and it takes time to do so. And so that's why that cutoff is that registration cutoff, which is to get back to the registration topic, is a very sensitive issue for administrators because we have very aggressive timelines for everything that we're doing. If you're doing early voting, which is up to the Friday, if you're doing polling place elections and you're doing mail ballot all at the same time, it's an extraordinary amount of resources, and the timelines are extraordinarily tight, and then you're also dealing with election judges and distribution of polling place materials, and all the election administrators here can list it and go on and take a little Xanax and then move on. And and so it's a lot more complicated than that. And the thing that we, this paradigm shift that we have from individual voter registration in each county to a statewide system has provided a lot more flexibility for us, a lot more integrity to the process. But the actual administration of the elections and the variability that you have among the counties, which suits some of these counties very well because we have such disparate geographic and population counties, that when we are moving towards some sort of centralized system or trying to get things a little bit simpler, I can't agree with Catherine Moore, the type of governmental governing agency, the type of county, your electorate, your geography, all of these things matter. And so this is going to be a long discussion. I mean, we're just really tipping the iceberg, but there's no simple answer. We really have to look at it from all directions.
This is Stephanie O'Malley. I just want to echo a little bit of what Pam said. We download our poll book also in a paper format for availability in the event of, that was a huge lesson learned in my county from 2006, and there are a number of counties that print their poll books to have them at the ready as contingencies.
Uh,
This is Ryan Call. One of the aspects of the conduct of elections which hasn't been addressed heretofore, which I think is useful and important to keep in mind as well, is the current statutory regimes as it relates to the ability to file challenges in terms of contesting fraudulent or questionable registrations, providing safeguards to allow the voter to sort of vindicate the right to vote if a contest is lodged. And currently the kind of mechanisms and machinery that are in place in terms of lodging those challenges, whether that be by party-sponsored poll workers, or poll watchers, rather, or by election judges, or sort of the timelines involved with being able to provide those challenges and then provide, you know, the appropriate time periods to resolve them. I think it, you know, either set aside entirely or certainly compressed to the point that they become unworkable or unusable as you compress those timelines with respect to elections, particularly as it relates to being able to challenge someone's voter registration. If you have same-day voter registration, well, then how do you verify if someone says, you know, I've just moved and I live in this county, or here's my photocopy of my utility bill with my name on it and I'm a registered voter. As a result, you know, the safeguards associated with being able to lodge challenges to registration as well as the eligibility to vote, I think, need to be thought about as we're tackling this problem. And certainly today we're not going to come to the resolution on all that, but I just want to make sure that that's in the mix in the minds of the members of the commission as they consider that, to adequately preserve the rights and the prerogatives of candidates and political party committees, as well as voters and election judges and election officials, to be able to lodge those challenges with respect to questionable or problematic registrations, or determining the proper method of resolving a challenge that's made with respect to a given voter's eligibility or permissibility to vote. I think the current system that's in place that allows for provisional ballots to sort of, you know, kick it over in the provisional category and sort of deal with it after the fact is a good system, but I think that there's some opportunities there that should be looked at. Thanks.
Okay, if there's no more comments, I think we can release Gary. He's very nicely standing back there for us.
Judge, can I follow up with a question? To his comments about challenges, what do political parties do in terms of challenging voters, Ryan? I'm trying to understand what your issue is.
Sure. Well, as presently the system provides and the mechanisms permit party-appointed poll watchers to lodge challenges with respect to the eligibility of a voter. In terms of actually casting that ballot, and that is most, you know, readily identified in the election polling place context, because you've got, you know, a voter showing up attempting to cast a ballot. The party poll watcher observes that either that particular voter doesn't show proper ID, or knows that voter doesn't live in the district, has personal knowledge of the fact that person is not eligible to vote in a given precinct or a given election. The ability of the party poll watcher to lodge that challenge, I think, needs to be preserved. I think political parties have kind of a recognized right to, on behalf of their candidates, to ensure the integrity of elections as it relates to that.
Right. And how often is that done? I mean, do you have any statistics or numbers about that in practice as opposed to
every
in statute?
Election.
Yeah, I understand. I know it does happen, but I'm trying to get a feel for, is this tens, hundreds, or thousands?
I probably wouldn't be in the tens to 50s to hundreds category, certainly not thousands. And part of it's because as elections have shifted, you know, by voters opting into the mail-in ballot process, there's really no mechanism to lodge a challenge to that voter's vote being cast. It goes into the mix, and there's real no effective way for a party poll watcher to observe or verify or anything like that. The current regime in place that provides timelines back farther in the calendar for being able to challenge voter registration versus voter eligibility to cast a ballot are two different kinds of challenges. And that currently, I think, is muddy and difficult to implement on the part of party committees or candidates.
Thanks. I'm Samantha Tooney. As
I'm glad you brought it up, Brian, because this is an area where the parties have some significant differences on what the challenge law says and does and allows a person to do. And I think it's very murky. We've always taken a much more limited view of what a voter can be challenged for, as the Democrats than the Republicans have. And I think that it would behoove us to take a look at that and try to make that clear so that we could avoid those battles on Election Day.
And I would concur with that. Let me just stress that the whole reason for these concerns and these the mechanisms that need to be put in place is to ensure that eligible voters can vote and questionable voters can have their vote and right to vote vindicated or set aside so that it does not unduly infringe the rights of other eligible voters, if there is a question there.
To jump ahead, I think we've covered most of the registration. I did want to mention one more aspect of registration enhancements that you may or may not be aware of. That is that the state of Colorado, along with 30-plus other states, have been working with the Pew Center for the States in a project to consider how to consolidate registration information across states. The idea being that fraud, this is a very dovetails very much on our former discussion, and that is that it is possible in our current system for people to fraudulently vote across states. This usually happens in the form of people who, for various reasons, may have two residences or be able to identify two residences across states. Sometimes it's college students, sometimes it's property owners, but there's various ways in which someone could identify two states as their primary residence. They could register in both of those states, they could get mail ballots in both of those states, and they could vote them. We are in a consortium right now which exchanges information about voting practices in one state and in ours, and in fact are pursuing a couple of cases right now in the federal authorities. The FBI has been working with us. We've been working with a U.S. attorney to pursue a couple of cases where we strongly believe that we had voters that voted in Colorado and another state. So, and one of the reasons why we want to join in this consortium or join in the Pew program is that it will allow us to intensify and grow that exchange of information and, in the long run, build toward a safer and more effective registration model, which will be able to spot when someone is clearly moving from one state into Colorado and when someone's moving from Colorado into another state. And when we can see that they've established residence in New Mexico and they no longer live in Colorado, and we can see that by a whole bunch of criteria because we exchange information with New Mexico, we then are in a position where we can make an intelligent choice as to whether or not that person is duly registered in the state of Colorado. So
this is an issue I've been pushing very heavily at NAST, the National Association of Secretaries of State. Currently, there are, I believe, three exchanges. We're in an exchange with eight other states trying to make sure that folks don't vote twice in these states. And clearly, this is an issue of major importance, and the reason I am pushing the expansion of this discussion at NAS is because I think that's a better way of approaching it than the other, which is for the federal government to mandate a nationwide score-type database. And as Judd pointed out, we've compared with these eight states. We originally had huge matches. Working with one other state, we found out that their data, not surprisingly, is not nearly as good as Colorado's data. But nevertheless, after we drilled down in conversations with that state and Colorado have both identified the same handful of folks who may have voted twice, and based on that, we've been talking to both our AHA and to the federal authorities about appropriate prosecution. This is very time-consuming and very, very difficult work, but we take it very seriously.
And one thing that it really makes you very proud to work in Colorado and the Colorado election system, to look at the way that other people are collecting and distributing this data. I mean, we feel very confident about our system as compared to some other states.
I would just say that if one of the initiatives on the ballot this year passes, it contains a statement that says electors shall be allowed to vote in every district in which they own property. And what that means and how that would be implemented and how we would deal with that has given a lot of us some nightmares.
Yep. Yeah, and we've discussed internally whether that would mean significant cost adjustments for us in terms of evolving score and the effect that that would have on special districts, and it would create a real can of worms. So the last topic that was sort of the preview of upcoming agenda items is the election calendar that I alluded to earlier. The MOVE Act was passed in September or October, actually, I think it was October, maybe even November, but it was passed late last year. The president signed it. It is the acronym Military Overseas Elections, I believe, is what it stands for, and so, or thereabouts. Voter empowerment. Empowerment. I did. You can't wing it with this group. There's a lot of acronyms. So the this law includes several provisions related to military voters, specifically about making sure that ballots get to military voters in a timely manner, which allows them to turn them around, and that there are various ways in which those ballots can be transmitted and various ways in which they can be received by the state. One aspect that we managed to basically ding the bell on every single aspect of this law, because we were really ahead of the curve when it came to military and overseas voters. The only thing that we can't do under our current system is allow a 45-day turnaround from the moment in which we distribute a ballot before the general election to the time in which the actual election count happens. The problem there is that our primary occurs so late in the cycle, and this is not unusual. There's a lot of states that are in our situation. But our primary occurs so late in the cycle that even if everything went absolutely perfectly and we met every single deadline without any problems, we would distribute at about 32 to 33 days. That doesn't meet the federal guideline. We have been informed that that they take 45 days very seriously, and it's not a number that they're prepared to sort of wiggle around the edges on. They will give us a one-time waiver if we make a proper waiver request that, again, meets all of their criteria. We are in the midst of creating that waiver request right now, and in fact, I brought with me, I didn't bring copies, but this is a copy of a letter we're writing to the DOJ because they have inquired. So there's a whole bunch of sort of elements going on, but DOJ has inquired, well, how are you doing with MOVE? Are you going to be in compliance for 2010? And they want an update as to how you're doing now, or how we're doing. And so Hillary Rudy, who's our legal specialist, legal analysis analyst in the office, has drafted up, and we're in draft form right now, so I'm not prepared to distribute it. But it is basically a draft of, here are your six elements that are in the legislation. We meet five of them. We don't meet this last one. Here's our plan for the last one. And the plan is that in 2010 we'll ask for a waiver, in 2012 we'll figure it out. So that means that in 2011 or 2012, we would have legislative changes which would allow us to meet that 45-day requirement. We would like for those changes to be in 2011, because if they're in 2012, we're already into the calendar, and it would be, and the change would be abrupt and difficult. We would like to make those changes in 2011, and we're kind of hoping that this group can help to lay out that calendar in a way that meets these elements and makes it attractive for the legislature to take up those issues, because a lot of the parties that are interested in this are in this room: special district, municipals, the political parties, citizen groups, and so forth. Those are the people that are most affected by this, in the broader election group, and then, of course, the county officials that need to be able to implement that and need to be able to set up their schedules. So anyway, that's why the move element is very important, and it'll be something that we'll need to attack before the fall, I would imagine, so that we can get something going. In the future, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah. That's right. So this law only affects federal elections. So as long as we're in a federal election cycle, that's something that would be important for that. In 2011, we're in an off-year cycle, so it wouldn't be relevant. Obviously, we would like to have legislation in 2011 so that, let's say it's signed and the governor signs it and it becomes law August 1st or July 1st or something like that. That would give us the time to sort of set up the dominoes for the next election cycle so that we're not in a position where we're violating other aspects of the law by not getting certain things done in a timely manner going forward. So,
what's the biggest domino? Like 30 to 32 days we seem to be able to pull off.
Right.
45, it would mean ballots would have to be printed 45 days before, and
that's right.
What bumps in the way of doing that?
Well, right now our primary is August. Somebody tell me what August. It's the 10th, isn't it? Isn't it? So it's August 10th. So, and then there's a certification of the primary results, which happens again under a schedule that gets us into September. And then all of that information is distributed to the county officials for creation of ballots, which again has a timeline. And so, and in fact, we have an entire office. I mean, Catherine Mikeworth runs our office where she lays out who is a candidate, who's, you know, can legitimately get on a ballot. What's the lettering of an initiative? You know, how is it all in all caps? Is it, you know, I mean, all of that stuff is done in an office in our division, and that information has to be distributed back to the counties, which is then given to HART or ES&S and so to the vendors, which then has to be printed, often printed states away, which is then sent back. I mean, the whole process is really cumbersome and difficult, and it takes a lot of time. And so right now we kind of figure the best we can do is around 32, 33 days. We would need legislation to push back the primary so that we can meet all of those dominoes after the primary to be able to get in the 45-day window to be able to mail. And that's the important thing, is to be able to mail out ballots, to get them in the air 45 days in advance of the election. Yeah.
Well, and while, you know, the process starts all the way back, starting with precinct caucuses in February and March, and that's kind of where the starting bell rings. And maybe, you know, considering those timelines that deal with the conduct of party caucuses, assemblies, designation to the primary ballot, election contests, provisional ballot verification that happens after those periods. So you really have to sort of compress and push back the entire calendar all the way starting in, you know, February.
Yeah, we actually, there's an 8-day lag after the election in order to sort of finalize the vote count. We were sort of hoping, well, maybe we get those 8 days, you know, maybe that gets us to 40, 41. I mean, we're pretty close. And no, that's not what they're interested in. They're interested in vote count day.
And there's a non-trivial issue here on when postcards and notices are mailed and how many notices are mailed. All of this really needs a complete rethinking and careful analysis so that nobody is losing any rights, but that we have time frames that in fact work. So. It's a complex issue, and we'd like to have some good recommendations.
So one thing I propose along those lines, I'm sorry, Carol, go ahead.
Are we the only state that has this problem?
No, there are, I believe, 22 states that face this same problem. Now, I should say there are about 45 states that face some move problem. There's a whole bunch of states that have move issues. There are, in fact, states, I'm not going to name names, I kind of know a couple, but I'm not going to name them. There's a couple of states that all six of the elements of move need to happen before 2010. And the only aspect that you can ask for a waiver on is the 45 days. The law does not allow for a waiver request on all the other elements. And you have to be able to transmit your ballots by all the criteria, like fax and email and all of the things that are required under the federal law, and you have to be able to receive those in that with those same sorts of technologies. We, fortunately, had our act together, and we're way ahead on many of these issues, so we are not facing some of the barriers that other states are. But there are 22 states that have primaries so late, which would require a waiver request on the 45 days. We have been in communication with those states, and in fact, there's been some exchange of information about how they're crafting their waivers and what those waivers would look like and all that kind of stuff. So so we're working with other states to try to figure out the best way to frame our waiver. It could very well be that some of the early states are going to submit and they'll get denied, and then we'll have a much better idea of, you know, what it needs to look like. We have been told that it's a tough thing, that they're not going to give away waivers like candy. So. Anyway, the long-term agenda, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it feels like a couple of assignments sort of go with this issue, and I know the clerks are experts at the calendar, and I mean the clerks could get together and work on the calendar, but first the parties need to get together to decide to change the time of the primary, which would trigger everything. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we really need to get started on that, it seems to me.
Actually, one thing that I was going to suggest is that it's, I think, the starting point is to understand the calendar, is to understand the barriers, the dominoes. And so one of the things that I think would be helpful for us to do would be for my staff to lay out the problem, sort of lay out the elements of the problem. Where are the calendar deadlines right now that what are they right now? And then we can sort of investigate to the degree that we need to move this one or that one or potentially all of them. So why don't I staff that up? I'll do that issue, and our next meeting we'll have some sort of documentation which would present that issue, lay it out, and then at that point it might make sense to for our individual constituents to start reaching out, or members to reach out to their constituents and start investigating what needs to be changed. Does that make sense?
Judd, I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes. Could I know the next item on our agenda is long-term agenda topics, and I'd like to spend just 2 minutes talking about gaps in the initiative law. We've run into a puzzling issue with regards the initiative process, an issue in which we felt like we did not have adequate tools. Let me see if I can lay this out. A petition is submitted, and we do a random sample. I think you're all familiar with how we go through. Pull out 5%, verify those signatures. Based on that 5%, we project the number of signatures that are accurate, and we certify or not. If we do not certify the item for the ballot, the proponents are then allowed a 21-day period within which to gather more signatures. When the additional signatures come in, we do a complete line-by-line analysis. Now, here's where the problem shows up. When we find duplicates, or if the process is only gathering signatures at 16th and Laramie, and is likely to produce a lot of duplicates, when you're comparing a line-by-line against a statistical sample, you've got a numerology problem, a numerical problem, because one disqualified signature here on that line by line would suggest that there could be 20 over here because you're doing a 5% analysis. We don't have good tools or good statutes to allow us to analyze that the way I think it should be analyzed. And it takes a lot of good thinking to get to the point where we can do that properly. And we've normally hasn't been a problem when the number of signatures that come in on the cure period is relatively small.
But we're now seeing at least one situation in which the cure signatures were a huge number, or like 70% mm-hmm. of the original submission. And all of a sudden, from a statistical analysis, it's a different ballgame. And so we'd like to lay that out for you with some detail. We probably will have some proposals, but we'd like to kick them around with you. And I'd like to do this without describing, you know, where we saw the abuse. And so we want a little time get behind this, but this is a hugely important issue and an area of great potential fraud and abuse. And so an issue that I personally want to make sure we
yeah, that. there's a real concern here that if groups start figuring out this way of doing it, all you got to do is get over the line to get the 5%, and then you get a cure period, and you could dump in a ton of signatures, and it's the potential to have duplicate signatures is enormous. And we could easily have a group that only presented 60,000 signatures, but because of the way we counted it, it looks like 95,000 signatures, you know.
So. And we have limited resources to do line-by-line counts. And frankly, we had folks working weekend, the folks we used down in Pueblo, and it was very expensive and very challenging. But we need to figure out a better way to do this. And if there are multiple of these that come in at the same time, we just physically can't do the work. So we're going to have to talk about that, our 10-day time frame to review the signatures after the cure period has come in. Does that make sense?
Kevin, did you have a
real concern for
us? This is Kevin Paul. I would certainly second the Secretary's suggestion and like for us to think about the practicalities that are built into the statute right now as well, not just from the Secretary's office standpoint, but also from a protester's point of view, where you are faced with enormous challenges because of the way that we maintain the petitions. The challenge of translating what is handwritten data into an electronic format that allows any hope of matching that with voter rolls that are kept electronically. And the time frame, I would suggest, is just it's completely unreal at this point.
Okay.
It's impossible. So I'd love to see us talk about that as well.
I suspect that the title board downstairs would agree with us. Considering that they are in a marathon session, which will likely go deep into the night and then probably into tomorrow, in violation of the law, by the way, because it's supposed to happen tonight, but they're probably not going to get done.
Well, I'm sorry, but I am going to have to leave. Let me say thank you. We're asking you to do a lot of work, and we will staff you potentially. We'll give you as much data as you ask for and handle. We've got, as you can see, we've got some things here that, on the one hand, I think this is being proven. We've got some things that are might be just come to work. And time for an initial problem. I think we've got to figure out.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Other long-term topics you can see on the list there. We are in the midst of doing a trial on a post-election audit. The law that required a post-election audit said that this 2010 primary would be the test for that. We have employed Colorado State University's Department of Statistics and Mathematics and Statistics. They have a lab up there to do statistical analysis on projects. We've employed them to do a statistical model that we can employ for the 2010 primary for a post-election audit. That's going to be our test cycle. If we find that that is workable or we can manage some changes that would make it workable going forward, then we can meet the 2012 post-election general election requirement. One of the things that I think would be very useful for this group is to, as we have those preliminary results from the 2010 primary, is for this group to, you know, take a real good look at it and see what it's missing, what we haven't done, what we need to do in the future that would more accurately analyze that election. so that we can go forward with future elections. And then the last one, which is the 800-pound gorilla, is rethinking of Title I. This is obviously a very difficult and long-term project. We'll probably have to do it in chunks, but it is the hope of the Secretary and I think many people in our division that we can look at some of the various things which are in conflict in Title I and try to clean it up some. I mean, it really is. It's each year we put forth an election cleanup bill. Each year it is woefully inadequate because at the same time that we're putting forth some stuff, new things are going on the books which are making life more complicated, and it's always a sort of ongoing balance, and we're fixing last year's problems. So so we really do need to look at it holistically, and I suspect that as we clear off a lot of the immediate problems, we can maybe try to get to that long-term issue. Any questions about those things? Yes, ma'am.
This is Stephanie. I have a question with regards to procedure and priorities and how you envision the commission addressing and or attacking this volume of work. What do you anticipate relative to a delivery document to be submitted as recommendations? Is that prior to the next legislative session, or, you know, when is that date? Because I think that's going to drive, or should drive, you know, where some of these discussions fall in the prioritization list.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. I think that, first of all, I'm not totally clear on what the Speaker has asked us to do. But let's say, hypothetically, that the Speaker has asked us to take on trying to formulate these ideas of mail ballot and enhanced registration. Let's say that. I assume that that's basically what he said in the press release. If that's the case, then one of our objectives, I believe, should be to really look at those issues in great detail in the next 6 months. And by the December-January time, have a very clear outline of what this commission is willing to sort of sign on to with regard to election modernization bill that we can then hand to somebody, whomever the likely people are that are interested in carrying a bill like that, and they can draw it up, and then we can work with that group to try to secure legislation which makes the most sense. I don't think that this group is, you know, about pushing legislation. I think it's more about, you know, providing a perspective on the thing that we know is coming. I mean, we know the future holds an election modernization bill. I mean, we've been told it's out there. We almost saw it this year. Chances are really good we're going to see it next year. So this group should try to create the four corners of that, you know, try to create the box so that we can have some say in, and that the people that are on the ground literally doing election work, be it the parties or the counties or the public interest groups or the municipalities and special districts, have a real say in what's in legislation. So the hope would be that we would have four corners set up by December, January, so that we could create the, you know, basis for future legislation should it come. With regard to MOVE, I think we're in the same boat. We probably need to have something prepared to hand off to legislators. Were we to find that the big problem is in our statute? It may be that the big problem is the parties, in which case we would turn to the parties and say, parties, help us. I suspect strongly that there are legislative parts to that as well. I know that there are legislative parts to that. So, you know, those elements are going to probably need to be December, January. That's why those are kind of the prioritized ones over the long-term-ish ones. So, Joe?
If 45 states are in non-compliance to MOVE,
yes,
would there be any action to change the federal law? That's the real culprit.
DOJ usually doesn't really work that way, but You know, I mean, the relevant example, I think, is probably the 65 Voting Rights Act. I mean, every state in its various forms was in violation of the 65 Voting Rights Act. And what it did was, I mean, it took a decade, but most states had come around, and most states had kind of fixed their problems and moved DOJ is working with organizations within the federal government to implement this, namely FVAP, and they are the impetus there is for the immediacy of the change. The law seemingly requires immediate change. Now, whether that actually happens on the ground is another thing. The last thing we want to do is find ourselves in litigation with DOJ. So if we can change it, if it's easy for us to change, then we'd like to change it. There may very well be states out there that see this as overly burdensome and an unfunded mandate and all the various ways in which they can construct it, and they may challenge this, in which case we'll just kind of sit on their coattails and, you know, see where it rides. But I think realistically, given that we only have one element, that we're out of compliance, and that we're, along with another, you know, 20 states, basically faced with only that one problem, well, we can fix it pretty easily. You know, and it's just a matter of calendar cleanup. But we'll see. I put new topics on the agenda, but of course, everything you've just heard was a new topic. So maybe we'll forego that this time and come, unless...
I did have one topic.
We've got a new topic.
And I don't know if it's in Rethinking Title I. This is Stephanie O'Malley, for those listening. I really think in the context of having discussions about mail ballot elections or polling place, even in the polling place elections, we have to talk about Colorado's current active-inactive statute.
Okay.
Those come in tandem.
Okay.
The information would be great to hear from the clerks, too. I mean, Stephanie O'Malley, you brought up the voter who opts out, the 40% who choose not to receive anything by mail related to voting. But I'm concerned about the non-stable addresses. I know in rural areas it's really easy to get to stable addresses, and ballots don't go flying all over the place. But with 16%, I understand, of the American populace moving once a year now, there are a lot of unstable addresses, and the concern is that a mandatory mail ballot election will disenfranchise a certain percentage of voters who, through no choice of their own, don't get a ballot because they don't have a stable address.
Well, and that brings in active, inactive. I mean, all of that is part of the same discussion. So I think that's a very good point. And so as we start to discuss those elements of mail ballot, we'll make sure that that's a topic area. Anything else? Okay, so we have made it to the fun part of the meeting where we all get out our calendars and we try to map out the next 8 months of our lives. So, are there days, I know we're not completely represented here, but are among those who are represented, are there days of the week or times of days in particular, or weeks in months, which are basically impossible? I'm gonna propose that we not do any meeting before May 13th, and that being a magic day in Colorado this year, and that we go after that because that's likely the very, very last day of the possible last day of the session. So if we were to start at May 13th on, we could try to schedule out. Yes?
And this is Martha Tierney. Are you looking at monthly, or what kind of a schedule are we talking about?
You know, I am open to suggestions. It seems like we could do this two ways. We could do two-hour-ish meetings monthly, or we could do four-hour-ish meetings every other month. Do we have thoughts on that? Or we could do whole day meetings.
No, I think the continuity is better, but I'm sort of looking at every other for a bigger chunk of time, because we're going to suck up more time anyway.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Well, I'm perfectly, the rule requires every other month. That makes a lot of sense to me. So why don't we do big chunks of time every other month? That would also allow us
afternoon,
to commit a whole afternoon. That's exactly what I was thinking, a whole afternoon. And we'll committee up a lot of these issues anyway, and so you'll be hearing from us as we distribute information to the committee members.
Okay.
And in fact, the hope is that as we distribute stuff, that this would be sort of a conversation that could continue online as well. If you see things that you don't like in the write-ups, or you see things that can be improved upon, please tell us, and we will definitely try to get to the next meeting with the best document we can, so that the discussion can be as fruitful as possible.
Okay.
So let's go. Let's go. Yes.
I also have one more suggestion, and that's that I imagine as we dive into some of these topic areas, we will break out into committee, and then maybe the committees can meet on the off month by
exactly.
telephone. And
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I suspect it would, especially, the one that always has occupied my mind since November has been the MOVE Act. And that one, I think, is absolutely going to require some couple of people to really dive in deep to it, because it's not the kind of thing that you can sit here and talk about with 15 people. So that makes a lot of sense. I think it makes sense for us to do the next meeting a little bit faster than 2 months, so we can kind of get going. So may I suggest maybe the third week in May? How are we looking for 17 through 21?
The appointment committees have their assemblies that weekend, 21st
and 22nd. Okay. Is that a very busy week for the councils then? Is that a very busy week for potential elected officials and elected officials?
It's almost zero out.
Oh, really? Okay.
Wednesdays are fine. Wednesday would be the 19th of May.
That's...
I did not do
that. Is that always a Wednesday problem, or is it just that particular one?
I actually have a board meeting in the third Wednesday.
Gotcha. Okay, that's good to know. How about how about the 26th? 26th is fine with me. You'll be you have an active lifestyle. You're not available that entire week? Okay. How about let's go back to the 20th. Is the 20th, or are we too close to the meetings for the parties at that point? In the morning? The 20th? Okay, let's go back to the 18th. How about the 18th?
Afternoon.
18th in the afternoon, all afternoon? They're not? Do you have... Okay.
However, I can make it to me for a manifest.
You would have to deputize somebody? That sounds pretty cool. You have the power to deputize people? Wow. That is very cool. I need that power. So it would the 18th work then for you? The 18th all afternoon maybe? 1 to 5? Okay. 1 to 5. Okay, so then we go May, June, July. How about July? And what is it? Garland, what's your, it's the third Tuesday in the month?
Every Tuesday.
Okay. How about then Wednesday, the 14th of July?
Well, what's the minute? I'm good till the 10th of July.
Okay. How about the 7th of July?
Yeah, That's the first Wednesday of the month?
That's the first Wednesday of the month. 7th of July, going once. Okay. 1 to 5. Okay. September. September, you want to, how about we go back to the 8th? First Wednesday in the month. September 8th. Garland, you look worried. Yeah, that's right. So the 8th work is good one then? Okay. Okay, 8th of September. 1 to 5. And November. Now, we don't want to conflict with election. How about the 10th? November 10th. Yeah, that would be the last day for provisionals, wouldn't it? Okay, so how about the 17th? No? Let's go back. Let's go. How about the 11th? Or are we still in the midst of the election at that point? Okay. Is it, Mickey, is it the 17th that's the problem or that week?
The 17th.
Okay, how about the 16th? Tuesdays? You have a Tuesday issue. How about Thursday, the 18th? That whole day, that whole week is gone. That whole week is gone. Well, I can't put it on next week because that's Thanksgiving. Oh, really? To the 1st of December? That's probably not a bad idea, actually. How about December 1? Great. December 1.
And this would be a meeting when we'd be getting close to having some recommendations ready.
I would think this would be a voting meeting, I would imagine. Yeah, that would make sense to me. Okay, great. And then we will worry about January when January comes, or at least sometime in the future. Yeah. I think in the future, I'm going to try to get us in the Blue Spruce. I mean, this is all lovely, and I appreciate the fact that you are willing to go to an odd formation, but in the future, we just have more mics and more just functionality in that room than we don't have here. So why don't we try to go Blue Spruce in the future? I will, you know, of course, we'll have agendas and we'll have information coming to you, but I would anticipate it's going to be Blue Spruce, unless you're otherwise. So great. Thank you very much for coming, and I really appreciate your willingness to work on all these very important issues. Great. Thanks. Bye.
Yes. Let me, yes, in fact, why don't I do this?